is live at 5 o'clock. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The Syrian government has denied being behind a mass bombardment of the city of Homs, where activists say between 210 and 260 people have been killed. These figures haven't been independently verified, but if confirmed, will be the highest since the start of the uprising against the regime 11 months ago. Russia is trying to delay a vote on the crisis in Syria, which is due to be held this afternoon at the UN Security Council in New York. Moscow said passing the resolution, which demands that power be passed to President Assad's deputy without amendments, risked taking sides in a civil war. Here, the Shadow Foreign Secretary Douglas Alexander said the latest reports added even greater urgency to the need for an international response. He said the logjam at the Security Council must be broken, adding that President Assad's time was up. Tens of thousands of people have marched through Moscow in protest against the Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin, who's standing for the presidency next month. They're demanding fair elections, claiming that the parliamentary poll won by Mr. Putin's United Russia party last year was rigged. The United Nations says the number of civilians killed in Afghanistan has risen for the fifth year in a row. It's estimated that more than 3,000 civilians died in 2011, which is up 8% on the year before. More than three quarters of the deaths have been blamed on the Taliban and its associates. The National Association of Pension Funds is warning of sharp practice and murky pricing by firms selling annuities to people seeking a retirement income. It says people who don't shop around properly can lose up to half their potential pension income. Forecasters are predicting that up to 6 inches of snow could fall in parts of southern England tonight. Dozens of sporting events have been called off this weekend, and Heathrow Airport says that a third of flights have been cancelled tomorrow. And more details about the weather. Rain in the north, or northwestern areas, I should say, will continue to spread southeastwards across the UK. Snow will fall on hills in the north and then at all levels in central, southern and eastern parts of England this afternoon and evening. And the snow will linger in the southeast overnight. BBC News and weather at 1:02. And now, the early music show. And today, Catherine Bott explores the world of cathedral choristers over the last 500 years. We begin with the choir of Lincoln Cathedral under Eric Prentice, singing the anonymous chant Virgo Prudentissima.
The sounds of Lincoln Cathedral. It's 12 o'clock, high noon. And as well as the bells and the choir of Lincoln Cathedral on CD, with which we began today's early music show, as you can hear, I'm really here in Lincoln. I'm sitting in the cloisters, and as well as the bells that keep on interrupting me, there are masons working in nice 21st century hard hats on scaffolding, because Lincoln Cathedral has been work in progress since the year 1072, when Bishop Remigius kicked the whole thing off. The whole atmosphere here is of continuity, spiritual continuity and practical building and cleaning continuity. It's very inspiring. The reason I've come to Lincoln Cathedral today is to explore cathedral life for singers. It's said to be One of the jobs, being a chorister or a vicar, choral or a lay clerk, it's one of the jobs that has changed least in about 500 years. In the 1560s, William Byrd was organist here. So we thought we'd come to Lincoln Cathedral to talk to today's director of music, Arik Prentice, and a couple of choristers, and also to the librarian, Nicholas Bennett, and find out a little bit about how today's life of a singer compares with how it must have been. O Lord, in thy wrath rebuke me, by Orlando Gibbons, sung by the choir of Winchester Cathedral, directed by David Hill. Now, we may be using Lincoln Cathedral as the basis for this edition of the Early Music Show, but the stories about choral life could apply equally to many of the other great cathedrals in Britain. To reflect that, the music that's threaded throughout today's programme is performed by a number of different choirs. The most substantial piece we'll hear is Byrd's Mass for Four Voices. Full details of all the music can be found on the Radio 3 website. Sing joyful. Well, here's a sort of typical day in the life of the singers of Lincoln Cathedral in about the year 1400. It all begins with matins at daybreak at 5 a.m. and then between 6 and 8 there are other masses. Between 8 and 9, 13 priest vicars celebrate chantry mass, and Lincoln Cathedral is stuffed with tiny, delicate chantry chapels. At 9 a.m., a very important mass, the Lady Mass. 10 a.m., High Mass. So we've covered 5 hours of the working day, and it's been solid services so far. At 11 a.m., dinner in hall. At 12 noon, the boys go to school for 3 hours. But then at 3, they sing evensong, then there's compline, and then the boys have playtime, which seems very fair. At 6, boys' supper, prayers in dormitory. At 7 p.m. or sundown, whichever is first, there's the curfew. The watchmen of Lincoln count the hours on a flute. After the Reformation, of course, there were fewer services, and it became much more like the choral workload of today's Lincoln Cathedral. But that's a very intensive day, a lot of singing. I've come upstairs from the North Cloister, above where we were sitting earlier on, with those wonderful sounds of scaffolders and bells ringing, is a remarkable architectural achievement. It's the Wren Library. Joining me in this long and calm room, with books on the north side and windows on the south side, is Lincoln Cathedral's Vice-Chancellor and Librarian, Nicholas Bennett. Nicholas, you were a lay vicar here, and your sons were choristers.
That's correct.
Now, nowadays, we know how choristers are recruited. How did William Byrd go about recruiting a crack team for his choir?
I think he was particularly concerned to get experienced voices. So one thing that Byrd did was actually to go out and recruit, and he sent one of his lay vicars, Henry Horner, as far afield as Lancashire in the early 1560s to look for choristers, and Byrd himself went off more locally to Newark Parish Church and to Louth Parish Church, where they still had choral foundations, to persuade some of the boys to come to Lincoln instead. So I think that was probably one of his main concerns. But he did possibly have another source of boys, and this is something that scholars aren't quite agreed on. At the dissolution of the Chantries, the Chantry founded by the Burghersh family in honour of the Henry Burghersh, who was a 14th century Bishop of Lincoln, had survived the dissolution in the sense not as a chantry, but the endowment had survived because there was a strong educational element in it. That it had paid for six boys to be educated at the local grammar school and to serve the masses in the chantry. Clearly the serving of masses was no longer going to be relevant, but the education was. So that actually survived the dissolution, and those sums of money which were to educate these boys were still part of the cathedral's expenditure every year. Now, we don't know whether those boys had anything to do with the cathedral choir under the new dispensation or not, but I find it hard to believe that these clergy were not going to get as much out of these boys as possible.
Glorificabo.
already described very briefly what the duties of the choir consisted of in about the year 1400. Nicholas Bennett, what sort of routine would there have been in Byrd's time?
Well, the chorister's day started very early, with school starting at 6 a.m., and they did 3 hours of school. Then they came to the cathedral, presumably some sort of choir practice, morning prayer at 10, followed by litany and either communion or anti-communion. So that would have taken them through till the end of the morning. Presumably a break for something to eat, back to school at 1, and then school till 3, followed immediately by evening prayer with an anthem at the end. So the whole working day would have gone from, say, 6 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon. So quite a long day, but the older choristers, when Byrd came, had sung under the Marian revival of the Latin Rite, and they would have been used to working musically very hard. Some of these masses they had been singing would be technically very challenging. Compared that to the Elizabethan settlement, where everything was more or less like a hymn, you know, sort of one note per syllable, they would have had very little to do until Byrd and his contemporaries had actually given them a repertoire to sing.
Thank you.
Music from Bird's four-part mass sung by the choir of Christ Church, Oxford, conducted by Stephen Darlington. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and today I'm investigating a job that's changed remarkably little over the last 500 years, that of a cathedral chorister. I asked the librarian at Lincoln Cathedral, Nicholas Bennett, what used to happen to the boys once their voices broke?
They would normally have been able to retain their place at school, even if they were no longer singing. Of course, before the Reformation, there would have been all sorts of liturgical jobs for them to do, carrying candles, censers, and whatever else. That had all finished. But there was an intermediate grade called poor clerks, and that would enable them to stay at school. I may have one example of one of Bird's choristers called Robert Duffield, and he was appointed to the choir in 1565, aged eight. And we know that he later on became a poor clerk. He was appointed sub-sacrist in 1574, so he probably has something to do with making sure the right things were out for the right service. And then he became a servant of the dean. And finally, in 1584, it was recorded in the chapter acts, he was to be given the next vacancy of a lay vicar for a tenor. So his obviously voice had settled down, he was going to sing tenor, which he carried on doing until his death in 1611. So he had, from the age of eight until his death, a whole lifetime of serving Lincoln Cathedral.
Oh.
Well, you listen to the annual service of nine lessons and carols, or you see carols from kings on the television, and don't those little choristers look sweet? And doesn't it seem like an innocent and holy world? Well, as you can probably expect, it wasn't always, and I'm sure it isn't now, but can any organist of any cathedral, past or present, match the behaviour of Thomas Kingston, who was organist at Lincoln between 1592 and 1616. In 1611, he was arraigned before the chapter of the cathedral for beating the boys and calling Mr. Dye, the master of the choristers, an ass. The next year, he was ordered never hereafter to meddle with teaching the choristers. In 1615, he was kicked out in 1616, and the grounds seem to have been that he is very often drunk, and by means thereof hath, by unorderly playing on the organs, put the choir out of time and disordered them. Then there's John Farrant, wasn't at Lincoln, he was down south in Salisbury, but a contemporary of Mr. Kingston. It was obviously very fashionable to be a disputatious organist then, and on one day, apparently, he walked out of evensong, went to the deanery, where he lunged at the dean with a knife, and then headed straight back to the cathedral to get there in time for the anthem. The dean survived. Farrant vanished. Well, I've come up some really rather terrifying steps, and now I've got my breath back. I'm in the Song School of Lincoln Cathedral, and with me is Eric Prentice, who's Director of Music, and I've got two choristers. I've got Stuart and Sophie. And so, Sophie, can you describe for me a typical day?
Yes, I'll wake up quite early and leave at home about 7:30 to be here for about 7:45. Choir rehearsal starts at 8 o'clock until 9 o'clock, and we'll then go to school, which starts at 9:15. I'll have a regular school day, and on Mondays and Thursdays, I will then come back here for choir tea, rehearsal and evensong.
And Stuart, I imagine your day is very similar, but different days of singing evensong, is that right?
Yeah, I do Tuesday and Friday.
How do you fit in things like football or hockey or other things like that?
I don't do sport, and most of my time is filled with school, homework and choir. That is my life.
It's a busy life. What about you, Stuart?
I'm not much of a sporting person either, but whenever I would like to do anything, I have to try and think of a time at the weekend when I've only got Sunday afternoon service instead of Saturday afternoon and Sunday morning, and then do it on the Saturday.
Do you think that being a chorister is good training? I mean, you must have to be very disciplined and organised, both of you.
I think it's great.
I think it's very good, and it will help me with homework once I get out of the choir, because I've got a lot less time to do it, but I still manage to get it all done in time.
What do you like most about being a chorister, Stuart?
There's quite a variety of music that you do, and it's kind of based on a long time schedule. So you have stuff from 600 years ago, and you can have some that were written in the 1900s as well.
Sophie, what about you? Do you have a favourite repertoire?
I like some of Tomkins' stuff, his second service, Mag and Nunc. I really like them. And I also like Jonathan Dev's pieces.
Now, I'm very interested in the picture you're both giving me, because in William Byrd's time, people only sang music that was quite new, didn't they? I mean, Eric Prentice, you can confirm this. I mean, there was no early music. It was all contemporary music.
Well, that's right. Most pieces were being written for cathedral choirs to sing at the time and being passed from one cathedral to another, weren't they?
So that is one big difference between chorister life of 500 years ago and now. Stuart and Sophie get to sing music of several centuries.
Yes, although of course we are very keen to make sure we continue to develop the repertoire in the same way that they would have done in William Byrd's time.
Thank you.
have three sections of the choir. The boys have been with us for a very long time, as have our altos, tenors and basses. The girls first sang on St. Cecilia's Day, the 22nd of November in 1995, and so they're in their 16th year, which of course for choristers is actually about three generations. So none of the current lineup know any different or remember any different. But we're very lucky, I think, in Lincoln, because it does mean that we're able to learn repertoire quickly and introduce new pieces at quite a healthy rate, because the boys or the girls sing three or five times each week.
About music lessons, singing lessons and instrument lessons for the choristers, what provision is made here?
Well, all of our choristers have singing lessons paid for them as part of the deal of being a chorister, and so that we can make sure that we're looking after their voices sufficiently on an individual basis. And many of the choristers play one, two, three or four instruments in addition to that. Some of them are very busy with sort of four or five individual lessons during the week, as well as their chorister theory, their participation in school ensembles as much as in the cathedral.
When you sing in here, when you come into the song school to rehearse, Sophie, are you conscious of the fact that so many choristers have come in here before you?
Yes, and obviously the girls didn't start till 1995, but if I think about all the boy choristers that there have been since the choir began, and they've all come up here, or somewhere in this cathedral, and they've all sung, they've all rehearsed. It actually makes you quite proud to think I'm carrying on something that has been going on for so long.
Thank you. A great cathedral inspires and cheers the people who work in it. My thanks to everyone I spoke to during my visit for sharing not only their knowledge of Lincoln Cathedral's history, but also their obvious affection for the place. Full details of all the music in today's programme can be found on the Radio 3 website in a couple of clicks of a church mouse. After spending a day in and around the cathedral, I went to Evensong. On a dank January evening, the congregation numbered less than three dozen. But no matter. For hundreds of years, through every kind of religious upheaval, this most comforting of services has been sung to give that peace which the world cannot give to everyone, whether or not they're listening. And a cathedral evensong will continue to lighten our darkness as long as there are choristers who are proud to be in choirs and places where they sing.
Lighten our darkness, we beseech thee, O Lord, and by thy great mercy defend us from all perils and dangers of this night. For the love of thy only Son, our Saviour, Jesus Christ.
The choir of Clare College Chapel under Timothy Brown, singing The Lord Bless Us by Robert White. The early music show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced by Barnaby Gordon. Well, this is BBC Radio 3. Now it's time for the Radio 3 Lunchtime Concert and a second chance to hear last Monday's live broadcast from Wigmore Hall in London. It was given by the Elias String Quartet, who are recent members of the Radio 3 New Generation Artists Scheme, together with the American pianist Leon Fleischer. But first we're going to hear the quartet on its own in the Langsamer Satz, literally slow movement, composed in 1905 by a youthfully romantic Anton Webern.